Hello, I'm FNH, and this is the Cthulhu Podcast. This podcast, home on the web, is at cthulhupodcast.co.uk. Welcome to this, the 24th of the Cthulhu Podcasts. Following last episode's request for stories, I've got my grubby mitts on a couple of really great stories, and a sniff of a third that I'll be bringing to you in the next few weeks. Thanks for getting in touch, you guys. I need more, however. So if you've written a creepy story set in or around the 1920s, or a story set anywhen that includes elements of the Cthulhu mythos, then please get in touch. Send an email to cthulhupodcast@gmail.com. I'd like to remind you that I have set up a forum for discussing anything to do with the show or Lovecraft, so please drop by the website and follow the link to the forum. This is the second week of me trying to provide a weekly show for a trial period, and it's going to be in the usual format. The history segment will present some details of Crosley Cars, music will be from Kaplan's Melodists, and our story is part one of a 14-part story by Lovecraft, The Dream Quest of Unknown Kadath. I don't expect to be running the 14 parts of the story consecutively. It will be interspersed with other works, but you should expect it every other show or so. At least, that's the plan for now. So, let's get started. Crosley Cars. The Crosley brothers were set up in 1867 by Francis and William Crosley, when Francis, with help from his uncle, brought the engineering business of John M. Dunlop at Great Marlborough Street in Manchester. William concentrated on the business side, and Frank providing the engineering expertise. The brothers were committed Christians and strictly teetotal, refusing to supply their products to companies such as breweries that they did not approve of. They adopted the early Christian symbol of the Coptic cross as the emblem to use on their road vehicles. The company came out of the Great War in good financial shape. There was a controlled release of the surplus Model 2025 military cars onto the market, and deliveries of the 2530 that had been produced towards the end of the war restarted to sell to private buyers in February 1919 and continued until 1925. The car was slightly updated with a higher bonnet, resulting in a smoother scuttle line towards the windscreen. The 2025 had royal patronage, with examples being supplied to King George V, the Prince of Wales, the kings of Spain and Siam, and even Emperor Hirohito of Japan. Several 2530s were used by the Prince of Wales for his tour of India from November 1921 to March 1922, and also for the tour of South Africa in 1925. The Crosley 2530 model was manufactured between 1919 and 1925. Approximately 600 cars were made. Many, probably most of the cars, had the V-shaped radiator, but a flat type was also available as an option. The vehicle chassis was manufactured and sold on to other coach builders, who repurposed the chassis into a number of roles. There was a 7-seat saloon, a 5-seat tourer, a 7-seat limo, and even a 4-seat coupe. These cars were very expensive. The prices ranged from £975 up to £1,375. Here are a few stats about the car. It had a massive engine capacity, 5,431cc, four cylinders, and it had a 25.6 horsepower rating. Unfortunately, it only got 13 to 15 miles per gallon, but had a massive top speed of 60 miles per hour, and personally, I dread to think what the stopping distance would be at that top speed. The vehicle was just over 15 feet long, and 6 feet wide. The predecessor to the 2530, as I've said, was the 2025, which saw extensive use with the military during the war. Between 6,000 and 10,000 were painted military green. These cars were used for ambulance work, light haulage, mobile workshops, staff cars, and a great many were used as tenders in the Royal Flying Corps, where they had bench seats fitted front to rear. After the war, many were bought back by the Crosley Company, and had their coachwork rebuilt as vans, and sales of these continued until 1924, So there you go, a quick insight into one of the car manufacturers in the UK in the 1920s. All this information about Crosley has come from the Crosley website, and I'll put a link to that into the show notes at cthulhupodcast.co.uk. Next we have a 1925 track from Kaplan's Melodists. It's called Prisoner's Song. And so we come to the start of the book, The Dream Quest of Unknown Kadath, read for us by the delightful Maureen O'Brien.
Part 1. 3 times Randolph Carter dreamed of the marvelous city, and 3 times was he snatched away while still he paused on the high terrace above it. All golden and lovely it blazed in the sunset, with walls, temples, colonnades, and arched bridges of veined marble, silver-basined fountains of prismatic spray in broad squares and perfumed gardens, and wide streets marching between delicate trees and blossom-laden urns and ivory statues in gleaming rows. while on steep northward slopes climbed tiers of red roofs and old peaked gables harboring little lanes of grassy cobbles. It was a fever of the gods, a fanfare of supernal trumpets, and a clash of immortal cymbals. Mystery hung about it, as clouds about a fabulous unvisited mountain. And as Carter stood breathless and expectant on that balustraded parapet, there swept up to him the poignancy and suspense of almost vanished memory, the pain of lost things, and the maddening need to place again what once had been an awesome and momentous place. He knew that for him its meaning must once have been supreme, though in what cycle or incarnation he had known it, or whether in dream or waking, he could not tell. Vaguely, it called up glimpses of a far-forgotten first youth, when wonder and pleasure lay in all the mystery of days, and dawn and dusk alike strode forth prophetic to the eager sound of lutes and song, unclosing fiery gates toward further and surprising marvels. But each night, as he stood on that high marble terrace with the curious urns and carven rail, and looked off over that hushed sunset city of beauty and unearthly imminence, he felt the bondage of dream's tyrannous gods, for in no wise could he leave that lofty spot or descend the wide marmoreal flights flung endlessly down to where those streets of elder witchery lay outspread and beckoning. When for the third time he awakened, with those flights still undescended and those hushed sunset streets still untraversed, he prayed long and earnestly to the hidden gods of dream that brood capricious above the clouds on unknown Kadath, in the cold waste where no man treads. But the gods made no answer, and showed no relenting, nor did they give any favoring sign when he prayed to them in dream, and invoked them sacrificially through the bearded priests of Nasht and Kamantha, whose cavern temple with its pillar of flame lies not far from the gates of the waking world. It seemed, however, that his prayers must have been adversely heard, for after even the first of them he ceased wholly to behold the marvelous city, as if his three glimpses from afar had been mere accidents or oversights, and against some hidden plan or wish of the gods. At length, sick with longing for those glittering sunset streets and cryptical hill lanes among ancient tiled roofs, nor able, sleeping or waking, to drive them from his mind, Carter resolved to go with bold entreaty whither no man had gone before, and dare the icy deserts through the dark to where unknown Kadath, veiled in cloud and crowned with unimagined stars, hold secret and nocturnal the onyx castle of the great ones. In light slumber he descended the 70 steps to the cavern of flame, and talked of his design to the bearded priests Nasht and Kamantha. And the priests shook their shent-bearing heads, and vowed it would be the death of his soul. They pointed out that the great ones had shown already their wish, and that it is not agreeable to them to be harassed by insistent pleas. They reminded him, too, that not only had no man ever been to Kadath, but no man had ever suspected in what part of space it may lie, whether it be in the dreamlands around our own world, or in those surrounding some unguessed companion of Fomalhaut or Aldebaran. If in our dreamland, it might conceivably be reached, but only three human souls since time began had ever crossed and recrossed the black impious gulfs to other dreamlands. And of those three, two had come back quite mad. There were in such voyages incalculable local dangers, as well as that shocking final peril, which gibbers unmentionably outside the ordered universe, where no dreams reach. The last amorphous blight of neithermost confusion, which blasphemes and bubbles at the center of all infinity. The boundless demon sultan Azathoth, whose names no lips dare speak aloud, and who gnaws hungrily in inconceivable, unlighted chambers beyond time amidst the muffled, maddened beating of vile drums and the thin, monotonous whine of accursed flutes, to which detestable pounding and piping dance, slowly, awkwardly, and absurdly, the gigantic ultimate gods, the blind, voiceless, tenebrous, mindless other gods, whose soul and messenger is the crawling chaos, Nyarlathotep. Of these things was Carter warned by the priests Nasht and Kamantha in the Cavern of Flame. But still he resolved to find the gods on unknown Kadath in the cold waste, wherever that might be, and to win from them the sight and remembrance and shelter of the marvelous Sunset City. He knew that his journey would be strange and long, and that the Great Ones would be against it. But being old in the land of dream, he counted on many useful memories and devices to aid him. So, asking a formal blessing of the priests, and thinking shrewdly on his course, he boldly descended the 700 steps to the gate of deeper slumber, and set out through the enchanted wood. In the tunnels of that twisted wood, whose low prodigious oaks twine groping boughs, and shine dim with the phosphorescence of strange fungi, dwell the furtive and secretive Zugs, who know many obscure secrets of the dream world and a few of the waking world, since the wood, at two places, touches the lands of men, though it would be disastrous to say where. Certain unexplained rumors, events, and vanishments occur among men where the Zugs have access, and it is well that they cannot travel far outside the world of dreams. But over the nearer parts of the dream world they pass freely, flitting small and brown and unseen, and bearing back piquant tales to beguile the hours around their hearths in the forest they love. Most of them live in burrows, but some inhabit the trunks of the great trees. And although they live mostly on fungi, it is muttered that they have also a slight taste for meat, either physical or spiritual. For certainly many dreamers have entered that wood who have not come out. Carter, however, had no fear, for he was an old dreamer, and had learnt their fluttering language, and made many a treaty with them. Having found, through their help, the splendid city of Caliphias in Uthnargai beyond the Tanarian hills, where reigns half the year the great King Kuranes, a man he had known by another name in life. Kuranes was the one soul who had been to the Star Gulfs and returned free from madness. Threading now the low phosphorescent aisles between those gigantic trunks, Carter made fluttering sounds in the manner of the Zugs, and listened now and then for responses. He remembered one particular village of the creatures was in the center of the wood, where a circle of great mossy stones, in what was once a clearing, tells of older and more terrible dwellers long forgotten. And toward this spot he hastened. He traced his way by the grotesque fungi, which always seem better nourished as one approaches the dread circle where elder beings danced and sacrificed. Finally, the great light of those thicker fungi revealed a sinister green and gray vastness pushing up through the roof of the forest and out of sight. This was the nearest of the great ring of stones, and Carter knew he was close to the Zug village. Renewing his fluttering sound, he waited patiently, and was at last rewarded by an impression of many eyes watching him. It was the Zugs, for one sees their weird eyes long before one can discern their small, slippery brown outlines. Out they swarmed from hidden burrow and honeycomb tree, till the whole dim-litten region was alive with them. Some of the wilder ones brushed Carter unpleasantly, and one even nipped loathsomely at his ear. But these lawless spirits were soon restrained by their elders. The council of sages, recognizing the visitor, offered a gourd of fermented sap from a haunted tree unlike the others, which had grown from a seed dropped down by someone on the moon. And as Carter drank it ceremoniously, a very strange colloquy began. The Zugs did not, unfortunately, know where the peak of Kadath lies, nor could they even say whether the cold waste is in our dream world or in another. Rumors of the Great Ones came equally from all points, and one might only say that they were likelier to be seen on high mountain peaks than in valleys, since on such peaks they dance reminiscently when the moon is above and the clouds beneath. Then one very ancient Zug recalled a thing unheard of by the others, and said that in Ulthar, beyond the river sky, there still lingered the last copy of those inconceivably old Narcotic manuscripts made by waking men in forgotten boreal kingdoms, and born into the land of dreams when the hairy cannibal Gnofkes overcame many-templed Olathoe and slew all the heroes of the land of Lomar. Those manuscripts, he said, told much of the gods, and besides, in Ulthar, there were men who had seen the signs of the gods, and even one old priest who had scaled a great mountain to behold them dancing by moonlight. He had failed, though his companion had succeeded, and perished namelessly. So Randolph Carter thanked the Zugs, who fluttered amicably, and gave him another gourd of moon-tree wine to take with him, and set out through the phosphorescent wood for the other side, where the rushing sky flows down from the slopes of Larion, and Hatheg and Nir and Ulthar dot the plain. Behind him, furtive and unseen, crept several of the curious Zugs, for they wished to learn what might befall him, and bear back the legend to their people. The vast oaks grew thicker as he pushed on beyond the village, and he looked sharply for a certain spot where they would thin somewhat, standing quite dead or dying among the unnaturally dense fungi and rotting mould and mushy logs of their fallen brothers. There he would turn sharply aside, for at that spot a mighty slab of stone rests on the forest floor, and those who have dared approach it say that it bears an iron ring 3 feet wide. Remembering the archaic circle of great mossy rocks, and what it was possibly set up for, the Zugs do not pause near that expansive slab with its huge ring, for they realize that all which is forgotten need not necessarily be dead, and they would not like to see the slab rise slowly and deliberately. Carter detoured at the proper place, and heard behind him the frightened fluttering of some of the more timid Zugs. He had known they would follow him, so he was not disturbed, for one grows accustomed to the anomalies of these prying creatures. It was twilight when he came to the edge of the wood, and the strengthening glow told him it was the twilight of morning. Over fertile plains rolling down to the sky, He saw the smoke of cottage chimneys, and on every hand were the hedges and ploughed fields and thatched roofs of a peaceful land. Once he stopped at a farmhouse well for a cup of water, and all the dogs barked affrightedly at the inconspicuous zugs that crept through the grass behind. At another house, where people were stirring, he asked questions about the gods and whether they danced often upon Larion. But the farmer and his wife would only make the elder sign and tell him the way to Nir and Ulthar. At noon he walked through the one broad high street of Nir, which he had once visited, and which marked his farthest former travels in this direction. And soon afterward he came to the great stone bridge across the sky, into whose central piece the masons had sealed a living human sacrifice when they built it 1300 years before. Once on the other side, the frequent presence of cats, who all arched their backs at the trailing zugs, revealed the near neighborhood of Ulthar. For in Ulthar, according to an ancient and significant law, no man may kill a cat. Very pleasant were the suburbs of Ulthar, with their little green cottages and neatly fenced farms. And still pleasanter was the quaint town itself, with its old peaked roofs and overhanging upper stories, and numberless chimney pots, and narrow hill streets where one can see old cobbles, wherever the graceful cats afford space enough. Carter, the cats being somewhat dispersed by the half-seen zugs, picked his way directly to the modest temple of the Elder Ones, where the priests and old records were said to be. And once within that venerable circular tower of ivied stone which crowns Ulthar's highest hill, he sought out the patriarch Atal, who had been up the forbidden peak Hathegkia in the stony desert, and had come down again alive. Atal, seated on an ivory dais in a festooned shrine at the very top of the temple, was fully 3 centuries old, but still very keen of mind and memory. From him Carter learned many things about the gods, but mainly that they are indeed only Earth's gods, ruling feebly our own dreamland, and having no power or habitation elsewhere. "They might," Atal said, "heed a man's prayer, if in good humor. But one must not think of climbing to their onyx stronghold atop Kedath in the cold waste. It was lucky that no man knew where Kedath towers, for the fruit of ascending it would be very grave." Atal's companion, Bani the Wise, had been drawn screaming into the sky for climbing merely the known peak of Hathegkia. With unknown Kedath, if ever found, matters would be much worse, for although Earth's gods may sometimes be surpassed by a wise mortal, they are protected by the other gods from outside, whom it is better not to discuss. At least twice in the world's history, the other gods set their seal upon Earth's primal granite. Once, in antediluvian times, as guessed from a drawing in those parts of the Nakadic manuscripts too ancient to be read, and once on Hathegkia, when Bani the Wise tried to see Earth's gods dancing by moonlight. So Atal said, "It would be much better to let all gods alone, except in tactful prayers." Carter, though disappointed by Atal's discouraging advice, and by the meager help to be found in the Nakadic manuscripts and the 7 cryptical books of San, did not wholly despair. First, he questioned the old priest about that marvelous sunset city seen from the railed terrace, thinking that perhaps he might find it without the god's aid. But Atal could tell him nothing. "Probably," Atal said, "the place belonged to his especial dream world, and not to the general land of vision that many know. And conceivably it might be on another planet. In that case, Earth's gods could not guide him, if they would." But this was not likely, since the stopping of the dream showed pretty clearly that it was something the Great Ones wished to hide from him. Then Carter did a wicked thing, offering his guileless host so many draughts of the moon wine which the Zugs had given him, that the old man became irresponsibly talkative. Robbed of his reserve, poor Atal babbled freely of forbidden things, telling of a great image reported by travelers as carved on the solid rock of the mountain Ngranik, on the Isle of Oryab in the southern sea, and hinting that it may be a likeness with which Earth's gods once wrought, of their own features, in the days when they danced by moonlight on that mountain. And he hiccuped likewise that the figures of that image are very strange, so that one might easily recognize them, and that they are sure signs of the authentic grace of the gods. Now, the use of all this in finding the gods became at once apparent to Carter. It is known that in disguise the younger among the great ones often espouse the daughters of men, so that around the borders of the cold waste wherein stands Kadath, the peasants must all bear their blood. This being so, the way to find that waste must be to see the stone face on Ngranik, and mark the features. Then, having noted them with care, to search for such features among living men. Where they are plainest and thickest, there must the gods dwell nearest. And whatever stony waste lies back of the villages in that place must be that wherein stands Kadath. Much of the great ones might be learnt in such regions, and those with their blood might inherit little memories useful to a seeker. They might not know their parentage, for the gods so dislike to be known among men that none can be found who has seen their faces wittingly, a thing which Carter realized even as he sought to scale Kadath. But they would have queer lofty thoughts misunderstood by their fellows, and would sing of far places and gardens so unlike any known even in the dreamland that common folk would call them fools. And from all this one could perhaps learn old secrets of Kadath, or gain hints of the marvelous sunset city which the gods held secret. And more, one might, in certain cases, seize some well-loved child of a god as a hostage, or even capture some young god himself, disguised and dwelling among men with a comely peasant maiden for his bride. Atal, however, did not know how to find Ngranik on its Isle of Oryab, and recommended that Carter follow the singing sky under its bridges down to the southern sea, where no burgess of Ulthar has ever been, but whence the merchants come in boats, or with long caravans of mules and two-wheeled carts. There is a great city there, Dailath-Lean. But in Ulthar its reputation is bad, because of the black three-banked galleys that sail to it with rubies from no clearly named shore. The traders that come from those galleys to deal with the jewelers are human, or nearly so, but the rowers are never beheld. And it is not thought wholesome in Ulthar that merchants should trade with black ships from unknown places whose rowers cannot be exhibited. By the time he had given this information, Atal was very drowsy, and Carter laid him gently on a couch of inlaid ebony, and gathered his long beard decorously on his chest. As he turned to go, he observed that no suppressed fluttering followed him, and wondered why the Zugs had become so lax in their curious pursuit. Then he noticed all the sleek, complacent cats of Ulthar licking their chops with unusual gusto, and recalled the spitting and caterwauling he had faintly heard in the lower parts of the temple while absorbed in the old priest's conversation. He recalled, too, the evilly hungry way in which an especially impudent young Zug had regarded a small black kitten in the cobbled street outside. And because he loved nothing on earth more than small black kittens, he stooped and petted the sleek cats of Ulthar as they licked their chops, and did not mourn because those inquisitive Zugs would escort him no farther. It was sunset now, so Carter stopped at an ancient inn on a steep little street overlooking the lower town. And as he went out on the balcony of his room and gazed down at the sea of red-tiled roofs and cobbled ways and the pleasant fields beyond, all mellow and magical in the slanted light, he swore that Ulthar would be a very likely place to dwell in always, were not the memory of a greater sunset city ever goading one onward toward unknown perils. Then twilight fell, and the pink walls of the plastered gables turned violet and mystic, and little yellow lights floated up one by one from old lattice windows. And sweet bells pealed in the temple tower above, and the first star winked softly above the meadows across the sky. With the night came song, and Carter nodded as the lutenist praised ancient days from beyond the filigreed balconies and tessellated courts of simple Ulthar. And there might have been sweetness even in the voices of Ulthar's many cats, but that they were mostly heavy and silent from strange feasting. Some of them stole off to those cryptical realms which are known only to cats, and which villagers say are on the moon's dark side, whither the cats leap from tall housetops. But one small black kitten crept upstairs and sprang in Carter's lap to purr and play, and curled up near his feet when he lay down at last on the little couch whose pillows were stuffed with fragrant, drowsy herbs. End of part one.
Thank you, Maureen. I'm already looking forward to part two. So here ends the 24th Cthulhu podcast. Don't cry, my friend. It is not a sad time, but a glorious time. The Cthulhu podcast has gone weekly, so despite the bitterness of parting, you must concentrate on the future, when we shall meet once more in a mere 7 days. Until next time.
CthulhuPodcast.co.uk